This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the special focus section, 2017 Healthcare Heroes. And that's the headline on the front page. The actual stories begin inside. And first we start with the Lifetime Achievement Award, Making a Difference in the World of Heart Health. And this is written by Jennifer Henderson, and it's a question and answer with Dr. Harry Phillips of the Duke University Health System, title Professor of Medicine, Chief Medical Officer, Duke Network Services and Duke LifePoint Healthcare. Family members, wife Jane, daughter Catherine, son Thomas. Education, undergraduate, Washington and Lee University, medical school, Duke University. Internship, residency, and fellowship, Harvard-affiliated program at Massachusetts General Hospital. For more than 40 years, heart health has been the lifeblood of Dr. Harry Phillips' work. Phillips, a cardiologist and chief medical officer of Duke Network Services for the Duke University Health System, graduated from Duke University School of Medicine in 1975 and has been pioneering developments in the field ever since. I've been very fortunate, and I've made an interesting journey in a career from being an academic clinician to eventually being a physician executive, Phillips says. Much of his research and work over the years has involved clinical trials and device development, as these areas relate to cardiovascular disease, according to Duke. Phillips served as the co-principal investigator for a transformative global study known as GUSTO IIB, which ultimately changed the standard of care for treating acute heart attacks from treatment with thrombolytics or clot-busting drugs to emergency angioplasty or surgical intervention. His work has also involved training hundreds of fellows via the Duke Cath Lab and authoring hundreds of articles on cardiology. In addition to his position as CMO of Duke Network Services, Phillips serves as a professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine, as well as associate director of the Duke Heart Center. Earlier this year, he took on yet another role, CMO of Duke LifePoint Healthcare, a joint venture between Duke University Health System and Brentwood, Tennessee-based LifePoint Health. Founded in 2011, Duke LifePoint has since grown to a network of 14 hospitals. Of his career, Phillips says, all the way along, we've had the opportunity to help with safe, high-quality care at the community level. The credit goes to being part of great teams who are very focused on delivering high-quality care in the communities. What is your favorite pastime outside of work? I enjoy spending time with family. I'm still, after all these years, a runner and actually enjoy getting out around the Triangle, but I also enjoy spending time watching the Duke Blue Devils. I try to get to all the home basketball and football games. Why did you choose cardiology as your specialty? My grandfather was a primary care physician in rural South Carolina, and he developed symptoms of coronary disease at a very young age. So not only was I inspired by him about going into medicine, he also triggered my interest in heart disease and what it was all about. As I finished training, medical school, and residency, it was a time of explosion in cardiovascular knowledge. That intrigued me at the time, and it was very much just a natural to go into cardiology. I think there's very definitely an element there in my decision-making that was driven off the fact that heart disease remains the number one killer of Americans. What do you think has changed the most in your practice since you started? In the early days, we developed ways to treat patients with catheters, eventually balloons and stents. The interventional approach came to pass and made a big difference in the way we treat patients, especially patients with acute myocardial infarction or heart attacks. Subsequently, by the way, there have been tremendous innovations and new work done around percutaneous or catheter-based approaches to fixing valves, and I think that's sort of the new frontier now as we find new ways to treat structural heart disease with catheters. What do you find is most important from your contributions to cardiology over the years? I might point to research done in the 90s in which I had the opportunity to be the co-principal investigator for the first trial that showed that treating patients with a catheter as opposed to a clot-busting medication produced better outcomes for patients with heart attacks. This was the beginning and the shift toward treating patients with catheters when they appeared with heart attacks. Over the years, we've evolved that treatment tremendously with the addition of more sophisticated stents. With your analysis on angioplasty, how did that change the standard of care? There were a number of studies that built on my early work, some of which I had an opportunity to participate in. As we began to understand better what it took to treat patients with heart attacks, we realized that we needed systems of care. In other words, it wasn't just one hero in the cath lab, but in fact, we needed teams who worked in systems so that patients who were having heart attacks could be rapidly transported to the right location and get their blocked artery treated efficiently. This has been a major breakthrough. The mortality reduction that we've seen over the years in patients with heart attacks certainly relates to many factors, but the ability to intervene early and open the blocked heart attack blood vessel is clearly a big part of that story. What are some of your daily responsibilities at Duke Network Services? My daily responsibilities are to support a broad spectrum of community-based hospitals, specialty affiliations at sites across the country. We connect our affiliates with the expertise of Duke Medicine, and we do that through a number of programs. Our specialty networks have allowed us to collaborate with community hospitals across the country to provide access to high-quality heart, stroke, and cancer care. My particular focus is on helping with program development, providing quality oversight, and also promoting physician engagement, getting physicians on board in the affiliations work we're doing. What is the most challenging aspect of growing these affiliations? We're very blessed over the years to have had a rapidly growing network of affiliates really across the country. If there is a challenge, the biggest one is that they all have to be customized to meet the needs of the hospital and the community, so there is not a cookie-cutter approach here. What is the most rewarding part of your job? To work with teams of colleagues at Duke, Duke LifePoint, and community hospitals, all of whom are focused on delivering safe, high-quality care to patients and improving community health. Where do you see the future of healthcare for Duke in your current role? We're all recognizing how important collaboration is, particularly as we shift into population health. I'm very optimistic as we grow these collaborations. Duke LifePoint is another area where I'm really excited about the future. We are currently a 14-hospital network. We have the opportunity to continue to grow and provide more support for community hospitals. But I also think that Duke LifePoint Healthcare has been able to accelerate the quality journey at community hospitals. The past 2 years, we've seen a 38% reduction in hospital-acquired conditions at Duke LifePoint Hospitals, and this has really been a huge step forward in terms of patient safety at our community hospitals. And we'll read more of those stories if there's time at the end. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, they're picking up where a Raleigh institution left off. When Flyth Cyclery in Raleigh, which has been around 70 years, closed last summer, two employees weren't ready to leave the cycling industry. They started their own shop, Trails and Bikes, at Oak Park Shopping Center, using Flyth's hefty email list to spread the word, and even taking Flyth's remaining bikes. The experience has been a microcosm of the challenges any new business faces. It was a little daunting getting into it, co-owner Derek Frank says. Frank and partner Tim Karcher knew how to fix bikes, of course, and they got an invaluable tutorial in running a business in the final years as Skip Flyth pulled away from much of the day-to-day operation and let them learn. They saved money to get ready for their own launch and then landed a 2-year lease in a 1,400-square-foot spot at Oak Park for $1,800 per month. But getting a space was only one part of starting the business. The co-owners ticked through the other hoops they had to go through, including a business license, insurance, an alarm system, setting up phones, setting up retail accounts, and finding insurance. Much of their sales so far have come from a clientele similar to what they saw at Flyth's. It's mostly family stuff, says Karcher. The thing we see here is, I'm not a pro, I'm not a biker. Since opening in December, they have sold plenty of locks, pumps, lights, adult helmets, and seats. 3 months in and the shop's covering the bills, Frank says. The shop's not covering salaries yet, but Frank and Karcher are confident that will come. They've kept in mind a business maxim that was essential at Flythe for all those decades. Customer service matters, so they make it a point to be friendly and helpful and fix a bike as fast as possible. It's insane how many customers will support you if you are friendly and pleasant to deal with, Karcher says. Looking for investment capital, new accelerator lab coming to Durham. Triangle entrepreneurs can soon score a bite of the Big Apple. New York City accelerator Expa Labs is coming to Durham's American Underground. The entrepreneurship initiative, started by founders of Uber and Foursquare, is holding an information session at AU on March 22. And unlike some similar accelerators, entrepreneurs won't have to relocate to participate. Expa Labs is a six-month early-stage program that typically makes investments of either $250,000 or $500,000. Applications are being accepted on its website. Coach K wears pin about winning a different battle. Duke University basketball fans tuning in to watch their team in the NCAA tournament will also see Coach Mike Krzyzewski support the fight against cancer. Coach K will don a CEO Cancer Gold Standard pin during the tournament, as he has done in every game over the last decade, according to the CEO Roundtable on Cancer, a nonprofit founded by former President George H.W. Bush. The organization works on initiatives related to the early diagnosis of cancer and the encouragement of new treatments for the disease, among other areas. Its gold standard pin recognizes employers who have taken exemplary steps to help their employees and family members prevent cancer and receive quality care if diagnosed with cancer. Krzyzewski was close to former NC State University basketball coach Jim Valvano, who died of cancer in 1993. Modernist row houses draw a big reaction on Facebook. Biz loves hearing from readers on Facebook, and we certainly did after reporter Amanda Hoyle broke a story about plans for 10 modern-style row houses on New Bern Avenue, just east of downtown Raleigh. Very cool. Glad to see some modern design in Raleigh. Floor-to-ceiling windows, rooftop gardens, not a single Roman column and nary a vinyl siding, exuded Rob Jordan. Exactly what we need here, posted Beatrice Nee. Others were underwhelmed. Looks like a cemetery mausoleum to me. New Bern Avenue is the wrong place for these brutalist buildings. Ugh, wrote Carl Larson. And Carrie Pugh sighed, seriously? Those are hideous. Her advice deserves its own day on the calendar. Congrats to Dairy Terry Benferrato, president of Executive Accounting Services in Raleigh, for being selected for the Women's Advantage Shared Wisdom Calendar. The calendar features advice from women for each day, and Benferrato's mantra was selected for April 25. Her quote, plan your work and work your plan. Great advice, says Biz. Now, back to work. Banking on grasshoppers. First National Bank parent, FNB, which acquired Raleigh-based Yadkin Bank, is already making news in North Carolina. First National Bank is teaming up with the Greensboro Grasshoppers, taking the naming rights to their ballpark. The park will now be called First National Bank Field. The Triad is just one of the markets the Pittsburgh Bank is entering after it closed on the Raleigh Bank this month. Opening day for the Grasshoppers is April 6. Former Prime Minister speaks at Elon in October. The man who led the fight against Brexit and lost is speaking October 5 at Elon University. David Cameron served 6 years as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and 11 years as leader of the Conservative Party before resigning after the stunning Brexit vote June 23rd. Cameron now chairs the National Citizen Service, a 4-week summer camp initiative for teens he helped start early in his tenure as Prime Minister. Now we turn to the On Retail Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Sprouts debuts. Sprouts Farmers Market, the grocery store that opened March 15 at a new North Raleigh shopping center, is much more than just a farmers market. The 30,000-square-foot store, located at 9414 Falls of Neuse Road, is more of a mesh between a traditional Harris Teeter, a beefed-up Trader Joe's, and a scaled-down Whole Foods, but with its own design and discount offerings. There's still a bakery, a deli, a butcher, and seafood counter, as well as beer and wine, but there are also rows and rows of natural and organic fruits and vegetables showcased at the center of the store instead of tucked away at the edges. Sprouts is private label products ranging from laundry detergent and potato chips to kombucha, teas, and canned goods are a big focus throughout, and the bulk bins of nuts, granola, and spices let shoppers choose their own quantities. Produce is the heart of our store and about one quarter of our business, says Erin Miller, a company spokeswoman in town for the Raleigh store opening. There's even a display with a number of different kinds of produce being offered at any given time. For the new store, the sign showed 201 varieties, including multicolored beets, peppers, pineapples, papayas, and pears. What shoppers won't find at Sprout are traditional brands like Tide detergent and Coca-Cola. You might not always find the brand you're used to here, but we try to find the better-for-you options, Miller says. Phoenix-based Sprouts was pretty much unknown to East Coast shoppers until it opened in Atlanta in 2014. It expanded into Florida in February. The Raleigh store, its first in North Carolina, is the anchor tenant at the new Olive Park Shopping Center being developed by Raleigh-based DNN Development, LLC. Developer Nick Brown says the center is 100% leased. Triangle home sales push ahead in February. Home buyer activity in the Triangle isn't flinching as mortgage rates inched up in anticipation of an interest rate hike that was expected by the Federal Reserve. The Fed announced a rate hike on March 15. "We're all sounding like a broken record. Inventory is very low in both the new and resale sectors, which means the continuation of a seller's market," says Tom Gongaware, general manager of Allen Tate Realtors. "There's growing concerns over housing affordability in our market," he says. House flipping highly profitable in Triangle. The investment model of buying, selling, and rehabbing of houses for hopefully a quick profit, a practice known as house flipping, has been on the rise across the Triangle, according to a report by Atom, A-T-T-O-M, Data Solutions. 5% of all home sales in the region in 2016 were classified as a flip, and the number of flips was up 6% for the year. Nationally, home flipping activity was up 3% in 2016 to a 10-year high. By definition, a house flip is a home sale sold for a second time within a 12-month period. Why you'll see more of Advance Auto Parts. Auto parts retailer Advance Auto Parts has announced plans to accelerate store growth with 75 to 85 new locations in 2017, but the brand expansion may be even more pronounced as efforts are underway to also convert up to 200 CarQuest stores. It's a slight shift in strategy following 2 years that were focused on consolidating nearby CarQuest and Advance Auto stores, usually at the expense of the CarQuest customers. Spokeswoman Lori Stacy says the company will do fewer consolidations than what was planned when Advance Auto merged with CarQuest's parent company, General Parts International of Raleigh, in 2014. Store consolidations have shown mixed results, while conversions and relocations have shown better results, she says. So far, 293 corporate-owned CarQuest stores were converted into Advance locations, and another 334 locations were closed via consolidation with a nearby Advance Auto store. Rival grocery stores to go head-to-head at East Raleigh intersection. Across the street from where a developer of a new Walmart Neighborhood Market grocery store wants to break ground, rival chain Little U.S. is seeking to stake a new claim. Little has filed site plans with the city to build one of the chain's new 36,000-square-foot prototype stores at the northeast corner of the intersection of Buffalo and North New Hope Roads in Raleigh. The proposed site is directly across from a grocery-anchored retail center that was proposed and approved at the southeast corner of the intersection in 2015 for retail developer WRS Incorporated of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. The 42,000-square-foot anchor tenant for that center is expected to be a Walmart neighborhood market. Now we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, MaxPoint CEO learned from eBay. MaxPoint Interactive CEO Joe Epperson says brick-and-mortar stores continue to drive sales, even in the digital age. But the lines between what's digital and what's physical when it comes to retail strategy are already starting to blur. In a conversation shortly after MaxPoint reported fourth quarter and full year revenue of $46.3 million and $149.1 million, respectively, Epperson says Morrisville-based MaxPoint sees it all as an opportunity. Epperson credits experiences at his former employer, eBay, with fueling the idea behind MaxPoint. He says e-commerce is a powerful tool, but there's a huge part of retail, of sales, that are done in physical retail. There was a real need for technologies that helped companies with physical commerce, he says, adding that roughly 85% of commerce happens inside stores. The MaxPoint mission, to use technology to drive in-store sales, arose from that need. Even today, as the presence of digital in customers' lives increases, Epperson sees overlap between in-store interactions and e-commerce. You've seen Amazon opening physical retail stores, he notes. You've seen Walmart push to make that strong integration between the store environment and their online environment. You can order online and pick up your merchandise at a store, he says, and he doesn't see those interactions lessening. The distinctions between online and offline commerce are going to blur, Epperson says. What I think retailers are looking for is that seamless experience. Those will blend together, and we're building the technologies that allow them to create that seamless experience-enabled commerce. MaxPoint is thinking globally when it comes to its data-driven technology, which can predict down to the zip code what customers want to buy. The company got its foot going and in the water in the United Kingdom, which was off to a fast start in the first half of 2016. While post-Brexit caused a slight slowdown in the second half of the year, international remains a key priority, he says, and he's excited about the possibilities that lie ahead, particularly in continental Europe. We always take a very measured approach, Epperson says. Right now we are focused on Europe and we are focused on the UK and then the greater EU. We think those markets hold huge potential for us. Durham software firm raises money again, pushes for more market share. A year after its last raise, Windsor Circle is once again raising money. This time, it's $1.2 million in equity from 15 investors, according to a securities filing. It's a paltry sum compared to the Durham company's last two funders, an April 2016 round for $4.1 million and a $6.3 million infusion in 2014. The company, which counts AOL co-founder Steve Case as a backer, develops predictive marketing software aimed to help companies rack up repeat customers. CEO Matt Williamson says the company has been driving hard on a strategic plan that focuses on a specific segment of the market. We're making nice traction against that goal, he says. We're now bringing predictive data science via email, social, and display to large customer brands and retailers, he explains, pointing to a client roster that now includes L'Oreal, The Body Shop, Johnson & Johnson, and Skullcandy. Our investors are interested in us continuing to drive up market, and this round will help fund that effort, he says. Williamson wouldn't give details on investors, but he said existing backers participated in the latest raise. Windsor Circle is just the latest startup to raise cash in the Triangle. So far in 2017, the bulk of the dollars have been raised by life sciences companies, which is consistent with trends in previous years. RDU adds another direct flight to San Francisco. Alaska Airlines is adding a nonstop service between Raleigh-Durham International Airport and San Francisco International Airport under the Virgin America brand starting in October. While Alaska Airlines currently offers a nonstop service to Seattle out of RDU, the new flight will be a first for Virgin America, which Alaska Airlines acquired last year. RDU spokesman Andrew Sawyer says 200 local passengers fly to San Francisco daily, and that doesn't include people connecting to international flights out of SFO. It's more seats and more options, he says, adding that the Virgin America brand is an eclectic airline, complete with mood lighting. It's a neat experience, he says. The daily flight will depart RDU via an A320 at 9 a.m. starting October 20. It returns from San Francisco at 11:35 p.m. The flight will compete against United's nonstop to San Francisco service. Also this month, Delta's nonstop flight to Austin, RDU's first, took off from the tarmac. Raleigh Jetport undergoes $3.5 million expansion. Dirt is moving in Sanford as the Raleigh Executive Jetport starts a $3.5 million development project, one officials hope means more tax revenue. Airport Director Bob Hutes says the project could mean up to 6 additional corporate hangars when complete. That's in addition to the 8 currently in place. The current phase of the project involves some challenging utility work, as a water line is extended through soil that's hard to work with, he says. But the real challenge might be timing. While the phase is expected to finish in September, the goal is to get at least part of it ready much sooner to accommodate corporate flyers. We're trying to get a site ready within 60 days so that if somebody comes along and says, hey, I want to put up a hangar, we'd have a site ready, he says, adding that he's had several recent conversations with corporations interested in doing business at Raleigh Executive Jetport. Hopefully, as work progresses and they see the timing of everything, they can make some decisions. The airport is already home to about 140 airplanes and is at capacity. It receives traffic from the likes of Duke Energy and Caterpillar, but wants to increase that to boost the tax base. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. PhotonMD, spun out of Novon, sees big year for light therapy. A Durham-based medical company that's spun out of Novon is looking to take its first product to market later this year. PhotonMD, which focuses on light therapy, started in January 2016 after separating from Novon, which is developing a treatment for acne without the use of antibiotics. Novon's initial public offering closed in September and raised $51.9 million before underwriters' discounts and commissions. Novon was focused on a medical term, dermatology, and the light-based medical devices did not really fit that asset class, says Dr. Nicholas Medendorp Jr., president and CEO of PhotonMD. That's PhotonMD. Ultimately, PhotonMD was spun out as a portfolio company of NoBio, which has other intellectual property assets it is planning to take to market. Medendorp says PhotonMD is preparing for its 510K pre-market submission to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for its first product next quarter. The product will likely be cleared in the second half of 2017, he says, and also available to the marketplace later this year. While Medendorp declined to discuss the specifics of the product, he said it involves a safer form of light therapy for an aesthetic application. Medendorp previously served as vice president of medical devices at Novon. Prior to that, he served as vice president of research and development, as well as vice president of operations at Cree. F. Neil Hunter, founder and former CEO of Cree, is among Novon's biggest shareholders. He also serves as chairman of NoBio. Medendorp says PhotonMD will be leveraging technology for other indications as well, and that the company currently consists of 8 full-time employees. He expects to double the size of the company in the next 12 months. In terms of its commercialization plan and additional assets, Medendorp says PhotonMD will be raising additional capital in the future. He declined to comment further on funding. The company has office space at Keystone, Technology Park. Argos to reduce workforce by nearly 40%. Durham's Argos Therapeutics is planning to reduce its workforce by 38% from 122 employees to 76 employees, the company stated in an SEC filing March 9. Late last month, Argos saw its stock sink more than 65% in a day after an independent data monitoring committee recommended it discontinue a Phase 3 trial of rocapodencel T for the treatment of metastatic kidney cancer. The principal objective of the reduction is to enable the company to conserve its financial resources as the company conducts its ongoing review of the preliminary ADAPT trial data set and discusses the data with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, following which the company will make a determination as to the next steps for the rocapodencel T clinical program, Argos stated in its filing. BioAgilytics plans growth in Durham and Germany. BioAgilytics is beefing up in Durham. The contract research organization is expanding its existing 29,000 square foot space to roughly 50,000 square feet at 2300 Engelert Drive and is planning to hire roughly 60 employees by the end of this year, says President and CEO Jim Dayton. We've been fortunate that our business has been expanding at a rapid rate over the last year, says Dayton, noting that BioAgilytics hired roughly 40 people in the U.S. in 2016 and also acquired IPM Biotech based in Hamburg, Germany. We're over 140 people in Durham and 30-plus in Germany, says Dayton, adding that the company expects to be well north of 200 by year-end. The workforce in Germany will grow this year by about 15 employees, he says. As far as the 60 positions BioAgilytics anticipates adding stateside in 2017, those will be both scientists and support staff in areas like quality control and assurance, according to Dayton. He says he expects half of those hires to be local and the other half to come from outside the region. BioAgilytics has a specialty in large molecule work, which has been a growing segment of the research and development pipeline, notes Dayton. Much of the growth has been driven by oncology and immuno-oncology, he says, where the immune system is used to battle cancer. He says roughly one-third of the company's workforce holds advanced degrees, and the average experience level is about 15 years. The company's customer breakdown is about 50% pharmaceutical companies, 40% biotechnology companies, and 10% companies that specialize in other areas like agriculture, animal health, and cosmetics, according to Dayton. Sempra, with $231 million, weighs options after cuts. With $231.6 million in cash as of December 31, Sempra says it's review of strategic business options will be wide-ranging. The Chapel Hill-based company said March 13 that it has retained Morgan Stanley as financial advisor for the review, which was announced at the same time as a 67% workforce reduction at the end of February. In December, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration rejected its pneumonia drug, solithromycin, over liver concerns. Our corporate restructuring was implemented to enable us to conserve our financial resources, Sempra stated in a securities filing. A company spokesman said, the goal is to find the best way to utilize that cash to deliver value to patients and shareholders. He confirmed that the options may include sales, acquisitions, or partnerships, among other things. Heat Biologics adds Texas firm in $1.5 million deal. Shares of Durham-based Heat Biologics jumped more than 30% March 13 as the company announced its HS-110 vaccine for the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer has received the go-ahead for a Phase 2 trial. The vaccine is being tested in combination with Bristol-Myers Squibb's checkpoint inhibitor Nivolumab, spelled Nivolumab. Heat Biologics announced March 8th that it had agreed to acquire Austin, Texas-based immuno-oncology company Pelican Therapeutics, which was spun out of Heat Biologics in 2012, in a cash and stock deal valued at about $1.5 million. "We've been following Pelican and thinking about the acquisition for quite a while," CEO Jeff Wolf says. "I think as we're progressing in our clinical trials and as we see and better understand the importance of immuno-oncology combination therapy to have more sustained and lasting impacts on patients, it currently makes a lot of sense." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline: The Region's Undeniable Reliance on College Sports. It's not news that for Triangle sports fans, this is the best time of the year, March Madness. As usual, Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill are prepping to make a deep run in the annual men's basketball tournament that likely will grip the area's attention for 3 weeks. Generally speaking, college basketball and football suck up most of the disposable dollars reserved for sports in the Triangle. Even if you don't have season tickets to Duke, UNC, or NC State University sports on game day, you are seen at bars and restaurants all across this market watching the game while eating dinner. Carolina Ale House owner Lou Mashako says on most nights during the season, the average tab amount could be threefold in most of his eateries. During the 2016 NCAA basketball tournament, 14 U.S. cities hosted the rounds of 64 and 32, and there were 4 play-in games in Dayton, Ohio. Dayton is already proclaiming these games have generated more than $70 million in direct local benefit. In Providence, Rhode Island, yet another regular site for the NCAA, the economic impact was in excess of $3.5 million last year. And in Philadelphia, the host of the East Regional last year, the impact on the economy was about $18 million. So when the NCAA and the ACC collectively say laws like House Bill 2 will prevent them from selecting North Carolina sites, our lawmakers need to understand that while ideology has its place in debates, so do our economic interests. You may not like the way the NCAA or the ACC or the NBA are using their clout to push for HB 2 repeal, but you must consider the profit and loss impact of the law. And after that, if you still feel that repealing the law will mean our children will be less safe in public bathrooms and that trumps the economic benefits of college and pro sports for North Carolina towns, fair enough. Clearly, this has become a metro-rural tussle and the differences are getting wider. Currently, Steve Malik and his North Carolina football club are trying to convince folks at Major League Soccer that the Triangle is ready for an MLS franchise. I do not know if legislative actions have any effect on the decisions by the MLS board, but I do know several cities are fighting for that expansion. Malik will have his own challenges if he ever gets a franchise. It is not easy to compete against college basketball here, but he surely doesn't need additional roadblocks for his bid. Winning masks most ills, but maybe UNC and Duke will help us mask our self-inflicted blemishes, at least for the next 3 weeks. And the next viewpoint is written by Alexandra Serrata, the director of the Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center in Raleigh. The headline: Understanding What You Actually Pay or Paid in Income Taxes in North Carolina. A great deal of confusion abounds in discussions about state personal income tax rates and how they apply to income. This policy basic clarifies the difference between marginal and effective tax rates and gives a North Carolina specific example of how these rates work in action. A taxpayer's marginal tax rate is the tax rate imposed on his or her last dollar of income. In a progressive personal income tax system, the tax rate applied to higher levels of income is higher than the rate applied to lower levels of income. Such a graduated rate structure is better able to keep up with the growing economy and ensure that those at the bottom of the income distribution don't have to carry a heavier tax load than the wealthy. How marginal and effective tax rates worked in North Carolina prior to 2013. Before 2013 tax changes, the first $21,250 of any taxpayer's taxable income in North Carolina was taxed at 6%. The next $78,750 was taxed at 7%, and any taxable income earned over $100,000 was taxed at a top marginal rate of 7.75%. It is fundamental to remember that only income over the marginal tax bracket or income level is taxed at the next higher rate. Put differently, this means that no taxpayer actually pays the top marginal tax rate of their entire taxable income in state personal income taxes. So, how great of a share of total income do North Carolina taxpayers actually pay in personal income taxes? This question is answered by calculating a taxpayer's effective tax rate, which is the share of total income that he or she pays in taxes. Taxpayers' effective tax rates are usually much lower than their marginal rates. Confusion about how exactly marginal tax rates are applied to personal income can lead individuals to believe that their taxes are much higher than they actually are. How marginal and effective tax rates work today in North Carolina. In 2013, North Carolina policymakers adopted a low, flat income tax rate and did away with a graduated rate structure. While some credits and deductions were eliminated or reformed, not all were, and many have since been added back to the tax code. At the same time, policymakers have adopted a higher standard deduction that they often call a zero tax bracket. In 2017, the income tax rate dropped to 5.499%, and the standard deduction increased to $17,500 for taxpayers married filing jointly. Under these tax policies, the effective tax rate on income, now of 3.38%, is far lower than the 5.499% tax rate, and still lower than the effective tax rate of 4% paid on average by taxpayers before the 2013 tax changes. The change in the effective income tax rate since the adoption of the low flat rate was not as great as the statutory rate cut alone would suggest, because many credits and deductions were eliminated to pay for the rate cut, thus broadening the base of income subject to taxation. The elimination of credits and deductions and the capping of the value of itemized deductions, specifically mortgage interest and property tax deductions at the state level, mean that different taxpayers, even within the same income group, could pay different effective rates. This would be based on decisions they make about housing, college attainment, among other choices. It is also important to note that the effective income tax rate varies by income level. The decline in the effective tax rate has been greatest for millionaires. The change in the effective tax rate since 2013 for millionaires has been far greater than for middle-income taxpayers. And now we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Dana Widmar, Director of Special Projects for the Town of Cary. In order to address the long-term capital needs of the Town of Cary, Dana Widmar has been brought on board to facilitate a broad range of projects that require cross-functional collaboration within town departments as well as outside the organization. Previously a program manager at the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, Widmar is now the Town of Cary's first Director of Special Projects. Widmar will work with the Cary Town Council and Town Manager, Sean Stigall, to implement a long-term vision for the town that boasts a population of about 160,000 people that includes transit and other transportational projects. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How fun it is to work through the detailed technical issues while also adapting to the changing environment. What are some of your major goals for your position? There are major investments occurring over the next several years for transit and other regional transportation projects. We need to make sure these investments are consistent with our values outlined in the Cary Community Plan. We are a community that covers a large geographical area and includes people from a broad range of backgrounds. but we are still one Carrie. I want to help keep it that way. Education, bachelor's degree in landscape architecture from Michigan State University, master of public policy and administration from Northwestern University. Biggest worry? That we won't adequately protect our environment for our kids and grandchildren. Triangle area business people you most admire? The Goodnights. They've contributed greatly to the quality of life in Cary. SAS is a major employer and an important part of the Cary community. Family, husband Chris, three children, Madison, Elena, and Jake. Last book you've read? Leadership on the Line by Ronald Heifetz and Marty Linsky. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to news from around the state. Global co-working operator WeWork to open first North Carolina office in Charlotte. This is written by Ashley Fahey. Co-working giant WeWork has signed a deal to open its first North Carolina office in Charlotte. The company will open WeWork Stonewall Station at 615 South College, the speculative office project by Portman Holdings that's under construction now. WeWork is taking 51,547 square feet on the 8th and 9th floors of the 370,000 square foot building, which is expected to deliver in April. When we talk about where we want to launch a location, Charlotte makes perfect sense because it's one of the fastest growing cities. A ton of people are relocating there, and it's a top place to do business, says Adam Wasensky, general manager of WeWork's Southern Region. We want to be where people are living, working, and playing. WeWork is also looking to move into Raleigh, but no deals have been announced. The growth in co-working popularity is not new to Charlotte or other markets, but WeWork, headquartered in New York, is one of the largest and most well-known co-working operations, with 130 offices in 38 cities around the world. WeWork says more than 15% of its tenants are Fortune 500 companies, underscoring the fact that co-working has grown in appeal beyond tech startups. One of our fastest-growing segments are larger enterprise companies, he says. You'll have someone like Microsoft next to someone who was working in their garage yesterday. It's a cool strategy. WeWork Stonewall Station is expected to open by late summer, though Wasensky said he anticipates tours would begin in May. The space includes four floor-to-ceiling windows and an outdoor balcony. Wasensky says 615 South College's direct access to the Link's Blue Line and proximity to South End were key reasons why WeWork selected that office building for its inaugural Charlotte location. WeWork appears to be capitalizing on the growth along the Stonewall Corridor, which includes more than $2 billion of planned or active development. High Point Market sees drop in interest from international audience, blames travel ban. The CEO of the High Point Market Authority said March 13 that he expects President Donald Trump's travel ban that temporarily bars six predominantly Muslim countries from entering the U.S. to have a potential negative impact on attendance at the spring market that runs from April 22 through 26. Tom Conley, president and CEO of the authority, said he didn't have exact figures but believes international attendance at the High Point Market next month will be down this year. Market officials typically receive requests for letters of invitation from international market visitors who don't have multi-year visas. The authority then sends letters of invitations to the international market visitors, who present those letters to the U.S. embassy or consulate representing their home country, along with other documents in order to receive a visa. The authority's requests for invitations for this spring's market are down by over 50%, Conley said. On average, we get registration from over 100 different international countries, Conley said, adding that there is a lot of demand for home furnishings, specifically in the Middle East. The folks with money fix their homes multiple times per year. Even if there is a downturn in international travelers, the majority of visitors are from the United States, he said. Former Disney Imagineer plans to build Whirligig Woods theme park on 21 acres in Alamance County. Bob Baranek recently announced plans to develop Whirligig Woods, a theme park in Saxapaw in Alamance County. The park is planned at the intersection of Stockard Road and NC 87. Baranek, a Raleigh resident, is a former Disney Imagineer who helped design Epcot, Disneyland Paris, and popular attractions such as Pirates of the Caribbean, Splash Mountain, and the Haunted Mansion. He has purchased 21 acres for the park that he says will start with a train ride and a few other attractions, then grow over the years. Plans are to open in 2019. Baranek has more than 40 years of themed entertainment design. We did extensive research all over North Carolina, he says. We were looking at the potential markets and demographic patterns. The obvious solution is that the property is equal distance between the Triad and the Triangle. Saxapaw itself is already a booming destination. It is a very rural and environmentally friendly community and a perfect match for the park. And now we turn to read the executive voice column, focusing on Ashton Poole. And in a box next to the article called A Closer Look, name Ashton Poole, family, wife Fran, two children, Ashton Jr. and Vaughn, education, BS, Business Administration, UNC Chapel Hill, MBA, Northwestern University, first job, Hub Limited, a men's clothing store. The headline, methodical approach can bring best results. Ashton Poole now leads TCAP. And this is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Ashton Poole, the CEO of Triangle Capital Corporation, is on a mission to bring diversity to a company that has been mostly unchanged for the past two decades. With the support of his board and former TCAP head and current chairman, Garland Tucker, he's in the early stages of a plan to infuse the company with the next generation of financial professionals. A methodical approach to diversity will be a key going forward, he says. It's something I feel strongly about, he says, pointing to figures that show that diversity translates into revenue. I've worked for companies that were very diverse, both in locations in which they operated, but also in the people themselves. It spanned ethnicities, gender, and nationality. Obviously, I want to try to instill that into the Triangle culture as well. Poole says it's a long-term plan and something he doesn't expect to happen overnight. You do it carefully and you do it methodically and intently, he says, and you do it by asking questions when you're hiring. Who's really good at what they do and can add those attributes that diversity brings, he adds. Methodically is how Poole, also a licensed pilot, often approaches an issue. In the sky, if you're not disciplined, you get killed, he says. So too in business. It's a lesson he learned in his first job at the Hub Limited, a clothier in Crabtree Valley Mall decades ago. It was there he learned the importance of relationships. In a clothing store, you get told no 9 out of 10 times, Poole says. You have to keep trying. While the sexy part of selling a pair of pants is ringing up the calculation and figuring out your commission, there's more to the sale. You have to get it through the alterations department and call your client back when another pair becomes available in another color. That's how you do business. You call the client. You don't wait for them to come to you, he says. TCAP's mode of investing is relationship-driven, too, he says. Most of its deals happen through personal connections. We talk about the value of diversity within our skill set, and here, obviously, that leads to increased relationships, new territories, and new areas, Poole says. The company, which focuses on lower middle market firms, deals in a variety of industries from Fats Cafe Parent, Cafe Enterprises, to Dyson Corporation. But its sweet spot is family-owned companies. TCAP Chief Financial Officer Stephen Lilly estimates that the firm has just 1% of the opportunity that's out there. And here we are, one of the most active platforms, he says. One way TCAP can stand out is through its diversity push, says Poole. Poole got his fingers in a variety of industries, from retail to specialty chemicals, as a consultant with the Mack Group out of college. One day he'd be working for Oneida French Fries, the next for Mervyn's department chain. That ability to shift markets depending on the assignment would bode well for his future with TCAP. It was taxing coming up with a strategy shift, but not being part of what happens once the plan was enacted. So he transitioned to investment banking, taking on what would be a 19-year tenure at Morgan Stanley. With investment banking, from the conceptualization of what you're trying to accomplish to the execution of it, there's a definite path, something you can point to, he says. But after nearly two decades on Wall Street, Poole was ready for a change. I felt like I was starting to plateau a little bit, he says. With his family in Raleigh, TCAP seemed a perfect fit. He joined the firm in 2013 and became its CEO in February 2016. It's an opportunity that keeps evolving, Poole says, and he can't wait to see what happens next. And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can of Edward Marshall's column in the small business section, headlined Millennials Seek Engagement at Work. Marshall is an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. I need to sound an alarm bell. According to a 2014 Gallup survey, 68.5% of all U.S. workers were either not engaged or totally disengaged from their work. Only 31.5% were engaged. How can we compete in a global economy with numbers like these? Gallup defines engaged employees as those who are involved in, are enthusiastic about, and committed to their work and workplace. The numbers are even worse for millennials, with 71.1% disengaged. This does not bode well for business in the future, since by 2025, millennials will make up 75% of the global workforce, according to Forbes. Workers in general are disengaged because they own little, if any, of their work lives. This is even more true for millennials. They may agree with the company's vision and mission, but are not part of creating it. They may be somewhat aware of the business strategy, but don't see how it relates to them or their futures. They are usually grateful to have a job, but they don't own it. That typically belongs to their managers or supervisors. And yet, they are evaluated based upon whether they produce as if they do own them. It is an upside-down work world. They are disengaged quite simply because they have been disengaged by their leadership. And we'll have to stop there, as the article mentions that engagement strategies include more freedom, more diversity, more decision-making at work. That's needed. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.